Doc Rivers continues to time and time again not get it when it comes to getting...
Let him play!
You bet one bone to win 19. What site do you use where you can actually bet $1?
They let you do 50-cent bets.
Oh my goodness gracious.
Yeah, literally, like, he dropped Superman down, like, the drain, comes out. Like, God damn it, Superman. I don't know, honey. I don't know where he got that from.
From Los Angeles, this is Dave in the City.
Part of the DITCOW Sports Network.
Now, here's Dave Medina.
Good evening, sports fans, and a pleasure to have you here for the big golf show. Good to have you with us from the Dave in the City studios in Southern California. With a recap for you tonight of what was a really good golf tournament. The PGA Championship for 2020 was a most unusual scene, but it was a very good tournament. And it was a tournament won by Colin Morikawa, the pride of Northern California and Southern California together. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he's from La Cañada, Flint Ridge. He went to school at Cal Berkeley up north, so both sides of California can lay claim to him. And he had a great round on Sunday. Unbelievable. So we'll talk about all the greatness of his round on Sunday. In breaking what was at the time at least a 6-way tie, it may have been even as many as 8. Then on the 14th hole, he holds out from this little valley just off the green, and that's exciting. It gets people going. And on 16, he has a drive that rolls all the way up onto the green, very close to the hole. An amazing drive, a fantastic shot, followed by a similarly fantastic putt for eagle on the 16th hole. And it took what was a real dogfight and a really tough to call tournament and made it into a runaway. He was fantastic, and you can't help but not root for him. So with this PGA 2020 tournament, we have a recap show as we do with all these majors, and this will be our first post shutdown recap. I didn't think we were going to wait all the way till August for our first golf show, but we're here. And so too are our guests tonight. They would be John and Mike. And it's really cool to hear from these guys again. I missed you guys, covering the golf and everything. It's been a long time. So I think I want to introduce them one by one. We'll start with Mike. Mike, I realize that things were kind of crazy in the East Coast, and I understand you were without power for a lot of those days of the tournament, but I am glad you got it back in time for the final two rounds. So, Mike, it's good to have you back. How are you doing tonight?
Well, Dave, I've had better days, as I'm sure you were aware. The NHL, the second round of the NHL draft lottery was concluded earlier this evening, and the first overall pick is going to my favorite NHL franchise, the New York Rangers. So I can tell you, I'm just in a great mood. We're here to talk about golf. I don't want to go into a big tangent about hockey to start off the show, but as I'm sure you can imagine, I've definitely been better.
Yeah, I understand. But anyway, let's move on to John. John, good to have you back as well. I know you were without power for a significant part of that tournament too. How are you doing tonight?
We're doing well, Dave. If you had told me beginning of the year they'd be doing an August golf show, I'd say, yeah, we're just talking about the upcoming FedEx Cup and how the season's played out. Who would have thought it'd be the first major of the season just played? Just a crazy, crazy year. But yeah, it was the storm was. We didn't get as much rain as I think where Mike is in Jersey, but the wind was just unbelievable. It was like 70, 75 miles an hour, just completely knocked the whole entire state out of power. But got it back and for a Friday night, and definitely enjoyed the weekend's rounds of golf, which was great.
Yeah, it certainly was, and I think there was something to take away from every round this year. It was really a lot of fun, and so the best part I think was in the last day. Naturally, as we were seeing some just incredible shots, and it wasn't really just Morikawa alone. I mean, there were a lot of great shots. I mean, DJ made a nice run, even though it didn't amount to much at the end, but he did make some nice shots. He had a nice round, a lot of good rounds all the way across. Even DeChambeau started to recover a little bit toward the end. The one who didn't was the guy that a lot of people expected to win, Brooks Koepka. He was just pretty bad. But we should start with the winner. I mean, this guy was really something to watch. We also saw him in the Workday Challenge. He was great. They had the playoff hole against Patrick against Justin Thomas, where they had dueling 50-foot putts. It just was incredible. This has just been a really fun year for golf, despite the circumstances around us. So it's kind of nice to have golf as a little diversion as we try to recover from what has continued to be just a rough time in this country. So back to you, Mike. Let's talk about Morikawa. I mean, this is certainly a great story. You know, he's the pride of Cal, and he's won it for his state. A true Californian, as I mentioned, he's got roots in both Northern Cal and Southern Cal, so it's pretty cool. Let's talk about what he did over this weekend. It really was quite a time.
Yeah, he's someone who's obviously burst onto the scene in this last year. This was only his second major, but you know, his results so far as a professional or even just in professional events have been pretty remarkable. I believe he's played 29 professional events. He's missed one cut. He's won three times, and he's obviously one of those wins being a major championship this past week. So really just an absolutely incredible start to his career. And I think it really shows something about the mental resolve of the young Colin Morikawa, considering that, you know, that loss at Colonial with missing that really, really short putt, you know, for a young guy just getting out on tour, obviously he had won an event before that, the Barracuda, which is that opposite field event that they play out in Reno with the Stableford scoring system. He had won that, but because it's opposite field, you know, it's almost a quasi PGA Tour event. But to have that happen to him in the first week of the PGA Tour restart, and to be able to bounce back from it and win only a few weeks later at the Workday, which was held at Muirfield Village, just really showed a lot of resolve in him. And it shows a maturity beyond his years. And I really think that's, you know, one of the things about him is just that I think his mental makeup is so strong, because if you look at his physical attributes as a player, okay, you know, when Rory McIlroy came onto the scene, all right, well, the guy had this incredible length off the tee, was hitting the ball high in the air. Even though Koepka was older when he came on the scene, same idea, incredible length, high ball hitter. You know, Morikawa, he isn't that so much. He's pretty much average to slightly above average with length, but he's very accurate, and he just seems to be solid in all aspects of the game. And obviously the moment doesn't faze him, because that shot he hit on 16, the short par 4 from 290 yards, to put a driver within 7 feet and basically just say, okay, you know, this tournament's been up in the air. It's been close. At one time, 7 players were tied for the lead on the back 9. Just to say, hey, this is mine and I'm going to take it. That really showed some moxie. So I just think this guy has a ton of resolve. He's really just, you know, if you haven't been picking him on your FanDuel teams since the restart, you've really been missing out, because his form has just been incredible. He's, I think, one of the most mentally, maybe, I mean, it's a small sample size, so I don't know, like, if I'm really basing this off of enough evidence, but I would say that he's probably the most, I think, mentally strong player we've seen come in since, well, he's not this way now because he's had some struggles, but it almost reminds me a little bit of Jordan Spieth. That same mental toughness, the ability to bounce back, this ability seemingly to will his way to win. So, but he is different with Spieth in that he's a much more accurate player, whereas Spieth is kind of erratic and had that great short game. But he's just very solid all around and has his mental toughness. And I just think to, you know, in your second major to be in that pressure pack situation and to step up and to really hit one of the probably the great shots in major championship history. Well, I think, you know, if you wanted to explain to someone what Colin Morikawa is all about, I think just show them that shot and that'll give you a pretty good idea of what you're talking about.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And I think you made a fantastic point about the way he came back from the missed like three or less footer at Colonial, which would have forced a playoff. I mean, that's a tremendous point. To bounce back from that, very few golfers would do that. Very few, especially within the year. This is a tremendous job. And I was wondering, actually, for myself, was that his first major, like, to participate in? I think it was, right?
No, I think he played the U.S. Open last
year. Good to know. So let's go back to John. And, John, I wanted to get your thoughts on Colin Morikawa, too. I mean, just a tremendous story. What were your thoughts on his weekend on at the PGA?
I mean, yeah, it's funny. Like, you know, you read all the different articles and stuff heading to the week about what you know the gamblers are on and touts are on, and you know who's taking who for the FanDuel teams. And Mike is absolutely right. Like, his price on FanDuel and DraftKings was just so low compared to the top players. He was just an instant plug and play because he's just so consistent every single week. In fact, the only cut he missed was at the Travelers Championship this June. And that was after the aforementioned tough loss at Colonial. And then he had a poor last couple rounds at the Heritage. He was just kind of maybe burned out at that point and just missed the cut at the Travelers. But other than that, I mean, he's just extremely consistent every single week. You know, his ball striking is just one of the best in the world right now. You know, he can get a little streaky with the putter, and you know, that's kind of the one thing that's you could say has held him back in some of these tournaments, as evident by the miss he had at the playoff in Colonial. But you know, he started putting some putts together this week, and you know, look what happens. You know, he wins the tournament. You know, just the overall game is just very, very, very solid. You know, not really, like I said, if he has one weakness, it's maybe with putting, but when you hit the ball that well, like, you're just going to give yourself so many opportunities. And he did it on Sunday. He really did it all weekend. He didn't get off to a great start in the tournament, but when you finish 65-64 on Saturday and Sunday to win a major, and you know, in fairly tough conditions. I mean, they talked about it all week. You know, as the day gets on at Harding Park, it just gets colder and windier, and you know, to have those two rounds, just incredibly impressive. And you know we don't want to make long range forecasts about someone's career when they're 23, because you never know what's going to happen. But you know, he definitely has all the capability to be a multiple major winner. You know, the class of college players last year, the three main guys, so you have Morikawa, obviously has shown amazing promise so far in getting his first major. Then you have Victor Hovland, who only has one win so far, but he's been knocking on the door many times. You only figure it's a matter of time before he gets a big win. And then Matthew Wolf, he did win the 3M Open last year and has been close in some other events. So very, very, those three guys will be connected for their entire careers. But Morikawa, again, just incredibly talented, and, you know, wouldn't be surprised, honestly, if he kept this going in the next month and contended at Wingfoot at the U.S. Open. I mean, that's, again, that's another course where you can't miss off the fairway, or else you're in deep trouble with that rough. I'm assuming that's going to be long and thick, and the course is going to be hard and fast. I mean, you know, the USGA will set it up like that if they did. You know, I think it was 06 was the last U.S. Open there, but yeah, you know, you would figure he'll be in contention for that as well because of his impeccable driving and iron play. And, you know, we'll see if the putts can fall again. But very impressive from Morikawa, and, you know, definitely signs of things to come from him in the future.
Yeah, I feel like he's the kind of player that's here to stay. I mean, he's got a lot of great tangible quantities that are really good. I mean, Mike broke them down wonderfully, and you did too, John. And then there's the intangible quantities, the mental makeup, and it was definitely key in some of these big wins he's had this year. I would also like, I think another good comparison, if you know, Mike was talking about Spieth 5 years ago, both of those guys were really good at their short game 5 years ago. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, the putter maybe not so much, but the chip shots just fantastic. I mean, he's really been pretty good. Now, the one thing I don't know about is what Morikawa was doing with the sand, because he didn't end up in the sand a lot. But I saw a lot of players did, and we can cover some of that as we get into the rest of the field. But they were good performances all around. I mean, obviously, if you're going to have a seven-way tie as you make the turn into the final nine on Sunday, clearly there was a lot of good golf being played on that day. And there was good golf being played throughout the weekend. So, Mike, let's give it to you for your thoughts on some of the other players that did well here at the TPC Harding Park in San Francisco.
Well, when you frame it like that, I guess I'll start off with something in a positive light. I think you have to be encouraged by Jason Day's performance at this tournament. You know, we can go back to 5 years ago where Day won the PGA Championship at Whistling Straits, putting on just a fantastic performance. And then really for like the next year after that, he was clearly the best player in the world. You know, he won the Players Championship. He won, it's the Northern Trust now. It was still the Barclays back then at Plainfield. And you just thought the sky was the limit for this guy. And, you know, it still might be, but he's had a lot of back issues, you know, amongst other physical ailments. The back is really the main problem. He tried to adjust his swing a little bit to shorten it up, but it kind of throws it out of whack a little bit. So the guy's just had a lot of trouble staying healthy. And I also, yeah, I am pretty sure about this. His mother had a cancer scare or something going on. So he's really just had a lot of things going on for him. And he really, in the last couple of years, has not played very good golf. But since this restart in the last few weeks, he's put together some solid showings, not really in contention to win, but, you know, on the first page of the leaderboard, that sort of thing. He did have a chance in this tournament. Realistically, he was probably, you know, maybe, well, I don't know, he was 6 under entering the final round, so maybe 1 stroke back of where he needed to be to win, really. But yeah, he was definitely in contention on the back nine. It didn't work out. Hey, it happens. He didn't play badly, but it was good to see someone, you know, as talented as Day, and especially someone who has a reputation of being like one of the better guys on the tour, to see him have some good form again. And we just hope he can stay healthy, because if he can stay healthy and like put together a 5-year stretch, I'd be surprised if he didn't win another major. Another positive showing. Well, I don't like him. And, you know, after an early run in that fourth round, he did slow down and cough up a few strokes. Bryson DeChambeau. Now, I guess we'll do a segment on him a little bit later, and we can talk more about him, because he's obviously been maybe the biggest story in golf since the restart. But, you know, he hadn't recorded a top 10 in a major before this. In fact, I don't think he had even recorded a top 20 until now. So I guess just for him to be in the mix is a good learning experience for him. I think, you know, no one was really surprised by that. Matthew Wolf, who we saw with his during that charity exhibition match at Seminole, you know, when he was able to outdrive Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson on both of the long drive holes, obviously showed what kind of prodigious length he has off the tee. He made a good run there. He had I think it was a 4-hole stretch around the turn where he played the 4 holes and 5 under. Again, he was probably a little bit too far back to start the day, but you know, he was in the mix again. That's a good learning experience for someone who's, I think he's only 22 years old. So good job by him. And Scottie Scheffler, who he didn't play great on Sunday, but for a guy who doesn't have very much experience to be able to go out there in a major championship and to look as calm, cool, and collected as he did, I think it bodes well for his future. I don't know, like, if he has much future, like, success at a major championship in front of him, because when you look at his swing, it just seems kind of loopy at the top a little bit. The transition seems a little wonky to me. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a pro golfer, but that's just my casual observation. So, yeah, I guess that would be my some of my players who played well over the weekend.
Yep, and surprises we'll be doing in just a moment. But first, let's go to John and talk about some of the other top performers of the weekend. John, I'll give it to you.
Yeah, I mean, you had a really exciting stretch there when, you know, it was a, what, 7 or 8 way tie for the lead. I mean, it was really anyone's game until the chip in and then the eagle and the 16 for Morikawa. He pretty much clinched it. But, yeah, I did enjoy seeing Jason Davey up there as well. I mean, he's an extremely talented player, and especially with his short game and putting, I mean, you never really feel he's out of the tournament when he's on and healthy. And he definitely showed that this weekend. Definitely hope he can contend again in future majors. He's an easy guy to root for, like Mike had mentioned. Yeah, I actually was very surprised to see Paul Casey do so well. I mean, he had a horrible couple of weeks at the Memorial and then at the FedEx St. Jude event. I think he was almost dead last in a field of 78, and clearly that he found something with his swing coach because he looked pretty solid. Usually he's a very solid ball striker. And you know, in it's just the kind of putting holds him back, and he kind of, you know, falls apart a little bit on the majors on Sunday, but definitely he did not do that here. So kudos to him. You know, you could say this might've been his last best chance. I mean, he's 43 years old. I mean, I don't know. He could sneak up there again, but, a great weekend by him. Not surprised to see Dustin Johnson play well, although it just goes to show you golf is such a, I guess, a fickle game. You know, he shot 83 rounds in a row, basically. He shot 80 twice at the Memorial and then basically 78 at the 3M Open in round one, which is like an 80 on that course, and then withdrew and then shows up at the PGA and, you know, finishes second and almost wins. So a good performance by him. It goes on the heels of the good summer he's been having. And he won the Travelers Championship and is having a good year. Tony Finau did not fold under the pressure. Good for him. Usually he's a guy that kind of falls apart on Sunday as well. And he shot 4 under. He was right there for most of the day. Him and Bryson were playing together. Both had nice 4 under rounds. So you know, that was encouraging to see. I mean, he's always touted as one of the most talented players on the tour. Yet he only has 1 win. I think it's the Puerto Rico Open, which is, again, it's an opposite field event. So he definitely needs to start winning more to kind of elevate his status to where people think his talent level is. And, you know, not kind of falling apart was a good sign for that. I guess I'll mention Brooks Koepka, who, you know, talked all sorts of shit on Saturday night and then went out there and had one of the worst rounds of anyone in the entire field on Sunday. I mean, I put, you know, when I put my money on him to, I had a nice parlay going with Morikawa to beat Cameron Champ and Koepka to beat Paul Casey. And, you know, I thought it would be Casey that was 4 over and Koepka 4 under, but just a horrible, horrible round by him. And I don't know. I mean, his stats weren't that bad. I mean, he hit a decent amount of fairways and greens. It's just, I don't know. I'd have to go back and look at the shot tracker to see what happened to him. He just did not have it whatsoever. And pretty disappointing, you know, considering how he played last week in Memphis. He really saw his ball striking was amazing. If he had putted a little better, he would have won the tournament. I think one round he lost like 5 strokes to putting. And then you saw it again here for the first 3 rounds. You thought he was in contention to, you know, shoot 4 or 5 under and win it. And he was just awful. So, I don't know. He's playing this week at the Wyndham Championship. I would not take him in any betting pools or, you know, fantasy. I just don't think he'll be motivated for this tournament. But in any event, that was pretty surprising to see him come up with basically a dud on Sunday afternoon. So I guess that's kind of the comments on the top contenders. I guess we'll get to some of the other guys in a little bit here.
Yeah, and it's pretty much my takeaway with Koepka as well. I mean, he was bad. He had a bad final round on back-to-back events. That's pretty rough. Like, 4 over for a guy who had been the 2-time defending champion is definitely not what you would expect. And he might have gotten a little overconfident with his club selection as he was getting near that gauntlet that you were talking about, John, with like 10 through 14. Those holes are all pretty tough and varying levels. So, you know, you really just need to weather the storm. When you're in a place like that, you don't even worry about getting a birdie. It's just don't do the stupid thing and get a double bogey. And guys who did that managed to keep staying in contention, and that was sort of the feel for the round. Pretty much every day of that tournament. One interesting comment from Jordan Spieth. We talked about him a lot on this podcast, despite him not really doing much in the tournament. But number one, he had a great round on Sunday, so give him a little credit for that. He played better. But number two, he made a very interesting call after his round in a post-game interview on ESPN to it was Tom Rinaldi. He said that the course setup was such that the hole locations were relatively easier than they're relatively easy compared to what they were the previous three rounds. He thought someone was going to get a 30. Morikawa was very close. He's had a 31 on the back nine. So he was saying that someone would get a 30 on the back nine because of the hole locations and the setup. It almost happened. It was down to one putt on 18. Morikawa didn't need a birdie, but it was close. He almost got it. So he would have had a 30 if that went down, and he also would have had a 63, which would have been an amazing score on that course. So anyway, let's do surprise and disappointments, and we'll start with Mike. Let's get your recap of the two scenarios.
Well, I'll start off with a disappointment, and we'll go to Rich Beam. Now, I figure that Rich Beam should be expected to do well because, you know, every time I watched the PGA Championship on TNT, he was always on the television coverage, and they seemed to show most of his shots. So you figure someone who gets that amount of coverage would be expected to contend or make the cut or something like that. But, I wasn't able to view as much on Thursday and Friday because I didn't have power, but I didn't see anything of Mr. Beam on the streaming when I was able to watch. And he finished at 15 over through 2 days. And I'm looking at the scoreboard. It turns out the only people he finished ahead of were four club professionals and technically Cameron Tringali, because Mr. Tringali was disqualified. But Rich Beam was beaten by 16 club pros this week. So maybe he should – I don't know how old he is. I think he's in his 50s. But maybe he should consider not showing up if he's going to play like that. And it does go to show. It's like, why did TNT find it necessary to show this guy all the time? Like, what did that add to the viewing experience? So – but in all seriousness, to go surprises and disappointments, I guess I'll bring up Tiger Woods in this in almost a half joking manner, because Gary Williams was on Mad Dog's show a few weeks ago, and he made this comment. Well, it was a good interview up until he got into talking about Tiger Woods. And then he makes this comment. Well, you know, I think if he's healthy, he's the favorite at the PGA Championship. Wait a minute. Based on what exactly? The guy doesn't play that often. Yes, he won the Masters. Okay, but that was a year and 4 months ago now. And, you know, he did have that good tournament in Japan that he won. But ever since then, he hasn't played well. So what is it about Tiger Woods other than his name being Tiger Woods that would make you think he was the favorite? So, I mean, where he finished making the cut but not doing anything, that's kind of what I expected. So not a surprise or a disappointment for me. But if you look at what some of the pundits would be saying, they would be disappointed based on his result. But I don't know how you can expect much when the guy only decided to play one event leading up into this. To me, that doesn't make sense. I guess we have to say – Now, going into the tournament, he wouldn't have been a disappointment. But Martin Keimer shot 66 in the first round and then followed it up with an 82. So I don't know what that's about. Obviously, we know that Keimer, he has two majors and a Players' Championship. He hasn't done anything in years, though. But you just figured that when he fired the 66, it's like, well, here we go again. He's about to find something for the week. And it's not like I expected him to win or anything based off that, but you kind of expected it to be a solid showing. Now, surprise, I know John mentioned Paul Casey. I concur with that. At his age, you figure that he's just trying to maybe show enough form over these next this next year to be on the Ryder Cup team again in 2021, but wasn't expecting much out of him. Other surprises and disappointments. Yeah, well, I guess we have to go into Rory McIlroy again. It's like we have this discussion in every major now. You know, we're now 6 calendar years since he last won a major, which is just, if we had said that after the 2014 PGA, it would have been shocking. But I don't want to rehash old talking points. You know, I'm not really all that surprised in his performance, or disappointed, I should say, considering he has not played well at all really since the restart. But you know, the guy went when they had the match play here in, I think it was 2015, he went 7-0 in the matches, and you just figured, okay, it's a place he'll be comfortable in. They haven't redone the course or anything since then, but didn't get much going there. And I guess two other guys you'd have to talk about. Justin Thomas really didn't do anything, and he had just moved up to number one in the world now. You know, I know it's hard to keep that form going and everything, but still somewhat disappointing. And John Rahm, who, you know, let's be honest, I think we'd be a little bit surprised. You know, it's great that Morikawa won, but, you know, John Rahm burst onto the scene a few years ago, right out of college and seemingly ready to win, and he hasn't won a major yet. Now, I don't think it's necessarily a big deal yet at this point, but a little bit disappointing that he wasn't able to put more of a strong showing here, because I do think this course and how the course played kind of set up well for him, but it wasn't to be this week.
Yeah, I think the problem with Rahm is his demeanor really doesn't set up well for big events. He gets too flustered easily, and when he misses a shot, it's just like, you need to calm down a little bit, guy. It's just like he's always slamming the club, slamming the microphone, waving the thing around. Now, he didn't break his club. I saw somebody else do that. I forgot who it was. But that was pretty impressive. Oh, no, you know what? It was Shane Lowry. Yeah, Shane Lowry, he missed a shot. He was so mad. He did that classic, like, back crack on his knee or on his leg. That was crazy. Like, he was fired up on that particular shot. Anyway, let me give you a couple of surprises and disappointments. I'll be brief. Because the one I wanted to bring up was Leishman. Mark Leishman, I thought he was going to make the cut. He didn't. So, to me, I find it a surprising disappointment, because I thought he'd be better. I really thought he'd be all right. He was playing pretty well this year, too. So, I was a little surprised. But surprised on a positive note, I gotta give it to Justin Rose. You know, there have been, I think if you go back to where he missed the cut, I think it was either the Travelers or the 3M. He clearly was struggling, but to finish at 9-under and in, yeah, the top 10, that's a pretty good finish for Justin Rose. He's not getting any younger, and I gotta give it to him. I thought he had a pretty nice tournament overall, and a very good 67 on the final round. Not really a surprise or a disappointment. I just thought he was good. Xander Schauffele continuing to do a pretty decent job. I am looking forward to that moment, though, where he starts to really challenge for the actual lead. But being in the top 10 is not a bad thing at all. So good job out of him. Same scenario for Cameron Champ. I was really happy with how he did overall, though not so great on Sunday. And that's it for me. So, John, let's give it to you for surprises and disappointments.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with Mike. I can't really call Tiger's performance or McIlroy's performance a surprise or disappointment. It's kind of what you expected from both going in. I mean, I don't think anyone was picking McIlroy other than the fact that he had that great week at the match play at this course. But, you know, that's, what, 5-6 years ago now? I mean, he's just – ever since the restart of golf, he just – has not had any kind of great form like he did earlier in the year. So something's off with him right now. You know, I mean, he wasn't winning in the beginning of the year, but he was in the top 10, like contending every single week. Now he's just kind of, you know, shooting around even par or one under par, and it's just not really getting anything going. Same thing with Tiger. I mean, who would have thought that he was going to do anything in this tournament in terms of like the top 20 or even the top 10? I mean, he doesn't play. And when he plays, he just kind of, you know, he kind of just has some decent moments, but then also makes some mistakes and just hovers around par in a major championship. That's what I expected from him here. I mean, if you said to me, all right, he's going to finish 37th, like, yeah, that sounds about right before the week. I just, again, it's just all name recognition for him at this point. I mean, he just, you know, and Mike is right. He just doesn't play. And, you know, I get it. He's older. He's got back issues. He likes playing at the courses that he feels comfortable at. But let's be honest, like he really should have played like three or four more times after the restart of golf. And he maybe he would have contended in this tournament. I don't know. I just, you know, I just don't think it's helping him playing once a month before he goes to these majors whatsoever. But any event, in terms of other disappointments, you know, it was funny. The 6 out of 6 percentage for FanDuel and DraftKings this week was huge because not many big names at all missed the cut. I think almost all the top players made the cut. Just looking at some of the names, Matthew Fitzpatrick is a guy that a lot of people had who didn't play well, and he missed the cut. Ricky Fowler missed the cut, and the most hilarious thing you'll ever see when he goes to tap in like a 6-inch putt, like after he missed, and he like he puts the putter down and is kind of standing on one leg. You guys have seen when pros do that before. He completely whiffs and hits the ball literally 1 inch, and it counts as a stroke, and he missed the cut by one shot. So that's just typical Ricky Fowler, I guess, for you. But you know, in terms of guys that missed the cut, I mean, there was really no big names. I mean, everyone pretty much made it through. You know, some didn't do very well than others. I mean, I agree, Justin Thomas didn't really have anything. I mean, I think he had 2 or 3 double bogeys, which really killed him. But yeah, I definitely thought he would have been up in at least the top 10 contending. Same with Patrick Cantlay. Very disappointing performance by him. He hasn't had any sort of, you know, good finishes over the last mount. I mean, he did do well at the Workday Open, but other than that, pretty disappointing stuff from him since golf returned and here in this event as well. I'll give Cameron Champ some props as a surprise. Did not see that performance coming from him. I know he won a fall series event last year, but really hasn't done much on tour outside of that. So this was encouraging. He's touted as another one of the game's young rising players. And, you know, give some credit to Hao Tong Lee, even though he kind of, you know, didn't do so well on his Saturday round, but 8-under to start the 36-hole leader. You know, good job out of him getting into contention. And, you know, he had a really nice major at the Open Championship a few years back and, you know, clearly has some game. So we'll keep an eye on him going forward. I guess that's kind of the breakdown for surprises and disappointments. I mean, you guys did a pretty good job covering some of the other players.
Thanks, John, for that. And thanks for your recap. It was really easy to root for Hao Tong Lee. He really showed some real humility going through all that. They were, you know, the broadcast was cracking some jokes about his preparation, how he was on the course and how he was in the driving range like 6 hours after he finished his round. I understand that he took a break in the middle of that, but it was kind of a fun thing to kind of track. So easy to root for that guy. Very good spot. So I guess that's about it as far as recapping the field. We can talk about the broadcast, which just for the mere omission of TNT was a major improvement. Huge kudos to ESPN. I will defend the formatting of the broadcast because there was an article that came out on Friday Thursday afternoon that was complaining about ESPN putting the majority of their coverage behind a paywall. And I didn't think that was a fair criticism because of the way that you time shift this tournament. I mean, normally you're playing from like 7 a.m. Eastern to about 10 a.m. or 11 a.m. or 12 p.m., depending on what the tournament is. And then Golf Channel usually comes in, and this is on a typical tournament, and they go from 12 to 3, and then you're done. Well, you really need to think about the ESPN portion of the telecast as that PGA Tour Live part of the telecast, and think of it that way, because everything was shifted 3 hours. So ESPN regular coming in at 1 Eastern time, or I'm sorry, 4 Eastern time, it's not that outrageous because normally that would be 1 or 12. It's not a big deal. And then they go all the way to primetime. They go all the way to like 10 p.m. in the East. So to be honest, I didn't think that was a very fair criticism of ESPN's coverage. Overall, I thought it was great. CBS picked it up. The only weird thing is that not having Sir Nick Faldo until deep into Saturday just continues to be odd, and I know why. There's contractual obligations that are involved, but everybody else from CBS is on that ESPN leg for the, you know, the weekday coverage. So it just, it's a strange quirk of the coverage. But all in all, just a tremendous job. And Mike, I'll give it to you for your thoughts on the TV coverage.
Well, my thoughts on this will be somewhat limited because, you know, obviously I had the situation with no power due to Tropical Storm Isaias, and I didn't get power back until Saturday at like 5 o'clock, and most of Saturday. Once I heard that, I left where I was, but I was actually at my old, not the current place I work at for an internship, but my last job before law school. I asked my boss from that job if I could use his office because I had to do something for a law school project. And he's like, yeah, go ahead. So I was doing that all day. So in terms of catching like really the ESPN television coverage beforehand or the streaming coverage, I was able to have the, I was at my sister's place on Thursday. So I like had it on in the background, and then I had it on the streaming coverage on ESPN Plus on in the background at work, but muted, obviously. So, but addressing your point that you were making now, look, I think this kind of goes both ways with whether you want to criticize it for being behind a paywall. I do think there's some validity to that because, I mean, you look at this now for people like us, we're big sports fans. Are we really going to think much of forking over $5 to be able to watch 2 days of the ESPN, of the PGA Championship? And now I'm just going to milk the ESPN Plus subscription and watch the content until the next billing cycle is due, and I'll cancel it before then. And you know what? I think I'm getting more than a fair deal out of that. So it's fine for me. But for a more casual observer of golf, I do see how this is a little bit of a problem. I don't know if they're going to want to fork over the money to watch something behind a paywall. Now, obviously, golf has more of an older audience, so people like that sometimes like the concept. I can tell you, if my dad were still around, like trying to explain this to him, I don't know if he would have gotten it. So what I would say is that I think the 6-6 split was probably a bit too heavy. I think if they had been coming on at 2:30 or 3, even that, even though it's not much longer, I think the optics of it would have been better. So I would prefer to see something like that where they do like a 7.5, 3.5, or 7.5, 4.5 split, or a 7-5 split with more time on actual television as opposed to the stream. But, you know, from what I saw on the stream, it seemed like the quality was pretty good. Obviously I told you I didn't listen to any of it. I couldn't really, but, from the reviews that I was seeing on Twitter, that seemed to be getting pretty good reviews, Duval in particular. But, you know, with, even though I have said that there can be criticism leveled against the broadcast, look, this is a big step up from TNT and their ridiculous nonsense of just coming on at, for a East Coast tournament, coming on at 1 and then like basically ducking out at 6. It's just like, well, you know, what is this even? Or I actually forget what their hours were, but you know, their coverage was never good. It was weird. There was always these just rant like we talked about with Rich Beam. So obviously a big improvement. And then Sunday was great because, you know, I woke up, you know, actually after the coverage had started, and I basically threw it on at 10:30, and I was able to watch, you know, the beginning part on ESPN Plus, then a little bit on ESPN. I was basically watching golf that day for, I don't know, almost 10 hours, even longer than that. So it is nice that we are able to have so much of the golf now covered, so much of it available to watch for the PGA Championship, because we didn't have that option before with the TNT CBS arrangement.
Very much so. We got many more holes with the coverage this year than we did in any of the previous three. So lot of kudos just for that. And the quality of the broadcasting was just so much better. Like, you had capable broadcasters, even on featured holes or featured groups. You had Andrew Catalan, who we were talking about on text earlier when he covered the 3M, filling in for Jim Nantz on CBS. He's good. He's solid, and I think he does a decent job. And I forget who the other team was for the other group, but they were probably good, I'm sure. You know, you had Sean McDonough, you had Scott Van Pelt, like really the heavy hitters of ESPN covering this. Obviously not Mike Tirico anymore, he moved to NBC, but still a very good broadcast all in all. I think the only oddity to me, maybe there's just no way to do this, but it would have been fun to see a little bit of interaction between the ESPN guys and the CBS guys. And if you really followed the coverage closely, and again, like you said, like John, Mike, you guys probably had a lot of other stuff going on, so I can imagine you weren't able to follow this as closely as I did. But I did notice that it almost seemed like they were like separate broadcasts within a broadcast. So like you had the CBS guys come on, you know, Dottie Pepper and Ian Baker Finch and Jim Nantz and Amanda Bailey and all of the people, which I feel like even includes the technical staff. They were all doing their thing for like some of the shift, and then the ESPN guys would take over within the broadcast window. It would have been interesting to see them interact with each other. Like maybe have Scott Van Pelt and Jim Nantz in the booth for like a segment. Would have been interesting, kind of sheering on my part, but I thought that was a missed opportunity, I thought. So, John, let's give it to you, and let's get your overall thoughts on the TV coverage.
Yeah, definitely a huge step up from TNT. I mean, the fact that you literally, like on Sunday morning, I mean, I had gotten my power back and everything, so I was good by that point. Flipped on ESPN Plus Sunday morning at 10 a.m. and you literally saw you could watch the first shot of the final round. If you sat there all day, you could watch literally everything until 9 o'clock at night when the final putt was struck. I mean, you cannot get any better than that. And it wasn't, you know, sometimes for the early coverage, at least in the past anyway, on TNT, you would barely see any golf. You'd see. Well, if it was Tiger was playing, you'd see every single shot. But, you know, usually you'd see, you know, a couple maybe, oh, here's this club pro from, you know, Padunkadunk, Missouri, and let's see him hold his bunker shot. Like, you wouldn't see any, like, actual, like, golf and how the players were navigating the holes for the leaders later on in the day. Like, this was very in-depth coverage. I mean, the one of the first groups on Sunday was Jordan Spieth and Ryan Palmer. They had a course reporter out there. You know, they were showing shots, like they were actually showing golf from, you know, just about every player in the field. And, you know, it was really great to watch just from a pure, you know, wanting to see various players and just a lot of golf. And there was just no fanfare or additional gimmicks or, you know, storylines or anything added. I mean, it was great. So just for that alone and just the amount of coverage, I mean, it was really enjoyable to watch. And I see Mike's point about, you know, the distribution of the paywall versus the non-paywall. So what I think they should have done on Thursday and Friday is what they did on the weekend. So like I said, so on Sunday, you put on ESPN Plus for just 2 hours. So it was like from 10 to 12. Then you had the main ESPN from 12 to 3, which is obviously on cable, and then CBS from 3 to 9. So you only had 2 hours of the paywall on Sunday, and I think they probably should have gone back to that on Thursday and Friday. I mean, if they had done, like, again, like 10 to 12 or 10 to 1, and then the rest, yeah, on air. Maybe they'll adjust that next year. I'm assuming that the contract for the PGA with them runs a number of years. And if this is how they're going to use ESPN Plus overall for the PGA Tour, you know, I'd take my money. You know, I know the PGA Tour Live right now is through NBC Sports Gold, and I think that's going to stay there for another year, but it's going to move over to ESPN Plus. And if they're going to have this kind of coverage for every single tour event, I know they do their feature groups for, you know, for PGA Tour Live. I'm assuming that'll kind of continue with ESPN Plus. But, you know, if they could add even more coverage, I mean, it's certainly worth $5 a month. I mean, just a 100 times better than TNT. And in terms of the broadcasters, I agree. I think Duvall was fine. I mean, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't Faldo or you know, any of the great, you would say a great announcer. But he was certainly better, I'd say, than Paul Azinger. I would definitely give him that for sure. And then the whole announcers they had were just professional broadcasters. Like you said, McDonough, you know, Van Pelt was there. They had Dave Fleming, Bob Wischusen. I mean, these are guys that you hear, you know, calling like, you know, college football, college basketball, baseball. I mean, they know, you know, they know how to do a broadcast. And so it was just seamless. You didn't have Fox had what, like Brad Fax and Steve Flesch, who had never done broadcasting before, hop on to, you know, to call the U.S. Open, and predictably it was a disaster. So this was very good coverage, and I have to say I was impressed by ESPN, and so good stuff by them, and you know, hopefully they can expand maybe their golf portfolio going forward. I know they used to have a bunch of golf properties anyway, you know, like when the tour had like the, it wasn't the fall when the FedEx Cup wasn't around, like back, I want to say like 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, the tour had a shitload of tournaments in the fall, like after Labor Day when no one really watched golf, but it was on ESPN basically every weekend for 2 months. And, you know, maybe they'll get back to that a little bit more, but alas, I thought the coverage was great.
Yeah. No argument. It was just a tremendous job. So all the kudos to ESPN for just tremendous. I think it's a good point you make about how the quality of broadcasts on ESPN Plus was right on the same level with regular ESPN, which makes sense. I mean, it's the same people. It's the same people, you know, doing the camera shots and the play-by-play. But seriously, you definitely notice a big difference in the level of broadcast quality when you talk about the PGA Tour live. And have you experienced that yourself, John? Like, have you tried it a little bit?
I do not subscribe to PGA Tour Live at the moment. The pricing just doesn't make sense for me right now. Like I said, once it's on ESPN Plus, I'll subscribe for the $5 or whatever it is to get it all year. And plus, you get all the other sports too, like the college football, college basketball. You get soccer. You get everything on there for $5. It's worth it. But for just golf, I wouldn't pay that amount. But I have seen the, like, they give you some free previews every once in a while, and I watch it. And I definitely think the ESPN. Broadcast was better from what I saw than the PGA Tour live broadcast.
Yeah, I have the same takeaway. I mean, I have seen that free preview as well. Like, they've put some of that on Golf Channel, and then I'd be like, yeah, it's okay. You know, it's fine. But for the money, I think ESPN Plus would do a better job with it. So hopefully that's the case. And that's pretty much the summation of this tournament, which was a terrific job. The course was great. I guess we could talk about that too. Mike, do you have any quick hitters about TPC Harding Park?
Well, before I get to that, because John brought up Fox, I guess we should mention that one of the bigger items in coverage news since we last spoke is that Fox got out of their U.S. Open, and well, it wasn't just the U.S. Open, basically their USGA deal. And now they are essentially paying half of the fee. NBC picked up half of the remaining fee. So Fox is now paying the USGA for NBC to air coverage of their events. So just a brilliant ending. You know, listen, Fox did get better, but that first tournament was such a disaster. It was just an unbelievable train wreck. So, and just the whole idea of it never made sense. It's, you're going to have Fox come in and do basically one men's professional tournament a year. It didn't make sense unless they were going to try to do before the current current landscape of TV with just it being on CBS and NBC. ABC had some tournaments with ESPN. So if Fox was going to go and do something like that, it made sense, but that wasn't their desire. So just the whole idea never really made a lot of sense. And apparently there was a lot of division in the USGA about this. Originally, that the golf people didn't want to move it to Fox, but the business people did, and there was this big dispute over it. So the U.S. Open will be returning to NBC, so Fox will be out of it. But moving on to your question about the course, I'm actually going to disagree with you here. Now, I will say this. The course was set up really well, and it provided a good challenge. That being said, do I think this is a particularly good course? No, not really. There aren't really, except for 18, which it's memorable because of the landscape. I don't think it's all that. You know what I would really compare this course to? it almost reminds me of, I don't know if you watch this tournament much, Dave, John, you definitely have, Wailea Country Club, in a sense, in that the setting around it is really nice, but the course itself is kind of mundane. It's kind of right in front of you. There aren't many features that stand out. Now, Wailea is in Honolulu, so you got the beach nearby. You got the mountains on the other side. So this kind of reminded me of that in the sense that, okay, you're on the lake, but the lake really doesn't come into play except for the one hole where you got to hit over the ravine that crosses it on 18. The cypress trees are nice, but in terms of quality of the golf course itself, now, again, I reiterate that they set it up well. The rough was thick. The fairways weren't exceptionally narrow, but they seemed to be set up at a very good width to, at least for a tour pro, to be challenged. The course itself, though, I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I think that I've played two or three courses this year that are probably, I don't know if the location isn't as good, but if you just look at the golf course itself, probably better courses than this course, to be completely honest with you. So was I impressed with the golf course itself? No. Did it was it a nice setting? Yes. And did it obviously produce a compelling result? Yes, it did. And that can happen. Now, what I think really happened here is we see this with the PGA sometimes, in that they almost look to go to cities and locations, and the golf course is almost secondary. I would think you would see that with it's not on the Rota anymore, but they would try to go to Atlanta, so they'd go to Atlanta Athletic Club, and that's a course that kind of has fallen by the wayside in terms of its style and design. In terms of what's in right now, a course of that setup isn't really as highly regarded as it would have been like in the 1980s. So same idea here. They wanted to go to San Francisco. They wanted a West Coast event. And they took the course that they could get. So now they are going to go back to San Francisco, I think, in the late 2020s or early 2030s. But they will be at the Olympic Club, which has hosted a number of U.S. Opens and is definitely a superior venue than Harding Park. It might not produce as thrilling a result, but just in terms of the golf course, it's definitely a better one. So, again, it's almost like I find myself in a weird place here because, you know, if the tournament had been boring or terrible or whatever, then I would have been totally bashing the course. But it's just it's this interesting combination where I looked at the golf course and said, I don't see anything special about this place. But you know what? It's providing a very good challenge. So those are my thoughts on Harding Park.
No, I think your honesty is pretty solid here. There's definitely, I did see some similarities to the Olympic Club, but I'm not going to go out there and say that it's as good. Certainly not. I was on the course at Olympic Club, so I can certainly distinguish the differences between them. I mean, there was really not much in the way of like a water challenge, which doesn't need to be there. I mean, Riviera didn't have any water, and it's a very challenging course.
Dave, it's not water so much. The thing that like gets me about that course at Harding Park, it's like, okay, we're in San Francisco. It's known for its hills, and the course really doesn't have much in terms of elevation changes, yeah, which is usually a hallmark of a very good course. So that to me is kind of like, all right, well, it's kind of flat. Everything's kind of right in front of you. The routing is cool. I'll give it that. Like the front nine is kind of on the inside, and then the back nine goes like, and it encircles the front nine. That part of the design is pretty cool, but I don't think it's a great course.
It's completely fair. Completely fair. John, let's get your thoughts on the course. Do you feel similarly?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't remarkable. I mean, you know, when I was looking at it beforehand, because I had forgotten the particulars about it, because I do remember they had played the match play what, 5 or 6 years ago, and I remember it from that. But I honestly, I just remember that Rory had won. I didn't remember anything about the course, and I kind of remembered why I didn't remember anything about the course when I started watching. And when I looked into it before the tournament started, it's like, oh, all right, this could be kind of cool. I mean, all the fairways are basically really huge tree lines, you know, and the rough was going to be thick. So, you know, I knew it was going to be a test that you have to keep it in the fairway. But it just, you know, there's just nothing really spectacular. I mean, no holes that made you go, wow, I mean, this is something else. I mean, the drivable par four was fun. I mean, it's always good when a course has that, that risk-reward element. But other than that, I mean, they're all the holes were kind of just, all right, you got to hit the fairway, avoid the rough. And but if you hit the rough, then it's just you're scrambling for par. I mean, there wasn't anything really, you know, distinctive. And I agree. I think that you need to have some elevation changes for a great course. If it's just all flat, just going back and forth, it just kind of loses a little bit. I mean, it definitely was a good test for the players. I mean, you've seen some PGAs like really get out of control where you have like a 18, 19 under winner. And, you know, really guys didn't get to double digits here until the very, very end of the tournament. So, you know, 2 or 3 under was a good score on this course. And, you know, when that happens, it's a solid test. So I definitely am glad the way they set it up and how the championship played out. Just overall, I don't know. It wasn't special. I mean, they probably would come back here again for a PGA in the future, and I'd be okay with that. But, you know, it certainly isn't like, you know, you're not going to wow anybody at Harding Park. So I feel similar to what Mike said. I mean, it was fine. I mean, there's definitely been worse courses to host majors along the way. Nothing special, but it wasn't anything that was too memorable either.
Okay, very good, everybody. So we look ahead now into our schedule, and as you guys were alluding to, we have a remarkable amount of juice in only about 3 months, and it's because of the way that the pandemic has altered the schedule for this golf season. Coming up already, after stopover in the Wyndham Championship. We have the playoff. We start with the Northern Trust, the new Northern Trust. The old one was over at Riviera, at TPC Boston, BMW Championship, and then the Tour Championship itself, which was won by Rory McIlroy a year ago. And it's a whole convoluted system of points and things and missing cuts and making cuts and whatever, and what your scores are. That'll be an interesting scenario. But then, because we have a condensed schedule in the next few months, we go into the 2020-2021 schedule in September. We have the Safeway Open, and then the U.S. Open, which is now in September from Winged Foot. Ryder Cup, which, is that happening? No, that's going to be next year, so they're not going to do that this year. And we go on from there, leading our way into the Masters, which, for the first time ever in the history of this podcast, will be the last thing we cover. We usually cover it first, so it's a bizarre year, but for obvious reasons. Mike, let's get your look ahead at the PGA Tour and FedEx Cup playoff schedule.
Well, Dave, another tournament that got canceled was it would have been last week, would have been the Olympic golf competition. So hopefully that gets played next year, but that would have been held in Japan last week. So we missed out on that. You know, I would recommend tuning in to the Wyndham Championship. Sedgefield Country Club is it's a Donald Ross course. It's a really good one. So, I mean, it's not going to have the best field, but, you know, there's not much else going on with sports. So definitely worth. Well, actually, no. What am I saying? We got the NHL and the NBA, and we got baseball. So I actually strike that comment. That's incorrect. I guess I'm reverting back to like our normal PGA Championship recap, which we would do August every year, except and just figuring, all right, well, yeah, turn into Sedgefield. There's not much else going on, but this year there is a lot of going on. So, but yeah, no, listen. There won't be stuff going on during the day so much. So, yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. It's a great course. And for many years, you know, the tournament in Greensboro, it's one of the longest running events on tour. And for many years, it was the tournament before the Masters. So if you like read a book about an old, like I was reading a book about the 75 Masters, you'll just hear all these stories about how, well, at first, like, Nicklaus would get to Augusta a couple weeks beforehand. He'd be practicing in Augusta, and then he would, you know, just hop in his car and drive over to North Carolina, play the tournament, and come back. So you'd see a lot of golfers doing that. And, you know, I guess with it actually would be a good course to host an event at the week before the Masters, because there are some similarities between the courses. The greens at Sedgefield are they slope a lot. They have a lot of undulation. Now, they don't run them as fast. They don't set up the course as hard. But if they wanted to, they could make that a pretty good test. So definitely worth checking out. Then the playoffs start up. So one of the things they've done is there's no longer a tournament in the New York area followed by a tournament in the Boston area. They rotate each year. So no tournament in the New York area this year. So we'll be having the Northern Trust at TPC Boston, which I think is a good course. So worth watching, obviously. Then the BMW Championship will be at Olympia Fields, which I don't think has hosted a FedEx Cup event before. I know it hosted the 2003 U.S. Open, which Jim Furyk won, and I think it's a pretty highly regarded course. So then, obviously, the Tour Championship. Then, yeah, I guess we got to look forward to, what is it, 5-6 weeks. We got the U.S. Open, which will run the September 17th to the 20th. And then, you know, hopefully, keep our fingers crossed, we'll have the Masters from November 12th to 15th. So that'll certainly be interesting to see, you know, if and when it happens. But you know what? I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get golf in, because, you know, I was pretty skeptical about if this would be successful, because, you know, people have to move around. They're not in a bubble, but it definitely seems like, you know, from both the nature of the sport itself, where it's an individual sport, so there isn't this necessity of co-mingling with your fellow competitors. You don't have teammates. You can keep to yourself. And it just seems that obviously the rank and file members of the PGA Tour are obviously taking this seriously. If no one's really coming down with COVID infections, that's got to show you that they are taking measures to, you know, keep themselves isolated and keep themselves safe.
Yeah, definitely. They've done a great job, and it's very good to just make a point of that. The way that they force people to test negative before entering a clubhouse is an example. Great strategy. You know, some of the other majors that they've done, all pretty good stuff. So, John, I'll give it to you. We can talk about that too. We can talk about how the PGA Tour has handled the assessment of coronavirus and how they've implemented procedures to minimize the amount of contact and the amount of gathering in these events. I mean, they have way less people, way fewer people working these events now, especially with the PGA Tour. It's a really odd thing to see a major like that with no fans, and that's a shame, but it's what we have to do, and I think they've handled it very well. So, John, let's get your thoughts on the road ahead and any other thoughts you had as far as the scene.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they it was off to a shaky start at first. I mean, I remember the first week went off without a hitch, and then you had a couple players test positive before the Heritage event in South Carolina. Then they got through that. And then I honestly thought the Travelers Championship was going to be canceled, because literally the day or two before, you had multiple golfers and caddies either test positive or were in close contact with someone who did test positive. And you're like, oh my God, here we go again. But you know, credit to the Tour. They stuck to their policies. The players self-isolated and quarantined, and you know, they got through it, and I think they've only had one positive test in the last couple of weeks. I think Brandon Grace tested positive at the Barracuda Championship, but they've been doing, you know, great with the protocols, and it definitely helps, like Mike said, the nature of the game. It allows itself for social distancing, and the fact that, you know, these guys are independent contractors. Okay, if so-and-so tests positive, just, all right, he's off. He's not playing next week. It doesn't have an effect on the other 150 players on the tour unless they were in close. You're not going to have a scenario where all 150 players or 200 players on the PGA Tour are in close contact with each other in a room where you'd have to shut it down. I mean, I guess a worst-case scenario, if you had like 15 or 20 at once, maybe you'd consider it, but I don't think that would ever happen. So, you know, knock on wood, I think we can
we can say that golf will keep going and the schedule they have laid out for us will happen. And, you know, and we'll go into next year still having a golf season. I think they'll be without fans for quite a while. I know they stopped having fans at least through the tour championship, and they're going to reassess starting with the Safeway Open for the new season. But I don't see how they're gonna have any fans at any event until you know, a coronavirus vaccine comes through. That's just my opinion, but you know, we'll see what happens. But yeah, for the upcoming schedule, I mean, you know, I'm definitely, I've been into every single event since it came back, and I will continue to do so, just for, you know, either betting or FanDuel or just, you know, just watching the golf. It's been really enjoyable. Even like when you had crappy fields at the 3M Open, it was really still exciting to watch.
Yeah.
You know, even with Michael Thompson winning it. You know, and then the playoffs are going to do the same. It's going to be interesting because obviously they had canceled so many tournaments. It's going to be much more volatile, I think, the point movements in the playoffs. And then they'll have the same crazy system where the guy in the tour championship is going to start at 10 under, and then the 30th place guy is going to start even par. That's just such crap. You know, it worked out last year that McIlroy would have won it regardless, if, you know, even without the handicap of the scores, but you know, that's going to backfire at some point. And then, yeah, the U.S. Open, I mean, she said, we're going to be here before you know it in a month, and, you know, can't wait. And I'm sure Golf Channel and NBC will have wall-to-wall coverage, and maybe we can petition to get Johnny Miller to come back instead of just for this one week instead of Paul Azinger. That's the one thing. If Fox is gone, but Azinger is still going to stay on NBC, which is, you know, not good for us. But, yeah, it should be, you know, looking forward to all the events coming up. And I know we're hopeful about some sport, more sports coming back. College football is not looking too promising. No. So we can take all the golf we can get at this point.
Yeah. Of all the sports, I mean, I think golf is a clear runaway in the best position right now. And I think the NBA and NHL would probably be second and third, and it's kind of close. After that, holy shit, it's like, geez. College football, John, 1 to 10 scale, you think there'll be any college football in the fall? I mean, SEC always goes in thinking that they're going to have a season. But
yeah, I mean, I think right now they're, you know, you see all these people, you know, we want to play, and that's great. I'm sure that if I was 21 years old and playing college football, I'd want to play too, but sometimes it's not what you want, you know?
Right.
I think the SEC and the ACC and the Big 12 are probably going to push through this as long as they can, and then I just don't think it's going to be even feasible to play one or two games, and then it's just going to get all shut down. From what I've read about the not only the testing, which is completely, you know, we could go off on many, many tangents about the coronavirus response and how it's been handled, but the testing is, you're taking, you know, unless it's rapid testing, it takes four to five days to get a test back, and they're going to try to test the players about 2 to 3 days a week. It just doesn't make sense. And then if you have an outbreak that takes out your team, it's going to take out the team that you just played. And I one of the reasons UConn canceled their season, obviously they're independent this year, so you know the game started dropping, and you know they couldn't find replacements, what have you, whatever. But one of the main reasons that I read was that it was the first day of practice, the day that they canceled football, and essentially they couldn't even practice because you had some guys isolated for one reason, and you could only practice certain drills, and the guidelines that have been laid out are essentially, it's not feasible for them to even practice. That's what Randy Edsall was saying. So I just don't see how this is going to happen, and especially the optics of, okay, like we're going to have unpaid, ununionized college kids playing in the middle of a pandemic in empty stadiums. For what? Like for our entertainment, so the coach can make millions of dollars. I mean, I'm one of the biggest college football fans, you know, around. But like, it just doesn't make sense right now for them to do this. It just, you know, and the a lot of these schools are doing online classes only. So you're going to send the football team out there to play while the other students are doing online classes. It just, the whole thing. Unless the only way that they can like legit make this work is if they did similar to the NHL and the NBA, where they did a bubble. But, you know, that would admit that the major college football aren't amateurs, and they don't want to give up that grift just yet, so they can't admit that, so that can't happen. It's just, on a scale of 1 to 10, Dave, I think there might there are going to be a couple conferences that are going to try to start the season, but I don't think there's any way that they're going to finish. So I say there's not going to be any college football. I do think the NFL is going to play, again, because they're unionized, they're professionals, they collectively bargain all these different protocols and procedures. So I'm very, very confident of an NFL season starting and finishing, but I just don't see any path forward for college football. And they should all work together now to possibly, you know, if you believe what they're saying about a vaccine by the end of the year or early next year, to play an 8 to 10 game schedule starting in March. I mean, that would be the greatest thing ever, honestly, to have the, say that the NFL season goes and have the Super Bowl and then be like, all right, well, college football season is kicking off next month. I mean, that would be amazing. Like, who would not want that? So I know I kind of went off on a tangent, but I just don't see any way that it's going to happen this fall. In my opinion, I'd be shocked if they can somehow get through a season or even start. I think by the end of August, it'll be all done, honestly.
Yeah, I don't argue with any of that. I think your points are tremendous on both fronts. The NFL has got everything together. They've got everything worked out. There's a lot of money on the line, and they've got a pretty organized plan. They've essentially decided to play the season without fans. Obviously, there's fewer players and fewer teams involved, so it's easier to organize something. I think the only thing I would have said with the NFL is why didn't they restructure the schedule so that it was like baseball, where basically you would only play inside of your region. So maybe you play like one or two divisions, like, you know, AFC West, AFC, and NFC West, and NFC North and AFC North and that kind of thing. But all in all, I think they have a better plan. College football just continues to be so disorganized. Everybody's on a different wavelength with this sort of thing. You have the Pac-12, which is like, yeah, this is a bad idea to play at all. The MAC already pulled out. The Ivy League pulled out. And then you've got the SEC just walking in there, strutting their stuff into the saloon and saying, oh, we could totally do a full season in the fall. It's like, this is ridiculous. It's like, there's no way. I don't see it either. So that's pretty good. John, I'd say this one more thing before we get back to Mike. It's going to be a bummer not to be able to do a regular, you know, college football preview. I guess we could do it in the fall, but John, you're just your personal thoughts. Like, what do you think we're going to end up doing with football season? Like, will we have a football picks and just do NFL? Like, what's your thinking, feeling on all that?
Yeah. I mean, if the NFL is playing, I don't see why we wouldn't do picks for that, at least. I mean,
yeah,
you know, if some college football is played, I mean, I guess if there's like, what, 20 games a week, we could probably do a couple picks on those games. If they somehow end up playing a couple, if some of the conferences end up playing, we could do that. But in terms of like a full scale preview, I just don't, I would say forget that.
Yeah. I think
we would just take it on a week by week basis. But again, like, one last thing. All right, so what if three conferences play? Like, how are you going to have a national champion with three conferences? It's just so stupid.
It is.
I just don't understand it. Like, all right, you have, so SEC, ACC, and Big 12 play. Like, forget the season. Just have Ohio State, Clemson, Alabama, Oklahoma, and two other teams play like a tournament on a two weekends and just call it a day. Why even have these other teams play? That's what it's going to end up being anyway for the 4-team playoff. I mean, come on. It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. It really is ridiculous. Like, it's like, and then you have like bowls announcing, oh, we're totally going to do the game. Like, the Rose Bowl was the biggest one for me. It's like, really, guys? LA County is like one of the worst infection rates out of any county in the country. And you're going to go out there and say, oh, we are just feeling so good about the Rose Bowl being played with no season? How is that going to happen, you guys? Like, think about it. I just think that their confidence is a little bit silly at this point. Anyway, that was a real tangent. Mike, let's get your thoughts on, I would say, golf potpourri, but if you want to comment on football, you can too.
Yeah, this is just a really unfortunate situation that we find ourselves in. You know, I don't want to go into too much of a tangent about why we are where we are, but you know what? Look, you want to place the blame on where this originated from? Fine, that's fair enough. But let's look at the rest of the world, and let's look at what we can call first world democracies around the globe. Why are we the only country that hasn't been able to contain this and get back to some degree of normalcy at this point? I mean, it's been 5 months, so it's just, it's really a striking, it's just a striking example of how our society has become so dysfunctional and incorporated just so much nonsense into it that when we are faced with a serious crisis, a literal life and death situation, and one that the very like fabric of our society is in the balance, that we can't function, we can't go on some path, we just... Our response, it's just, it hasn't been sane. And that's why we are where we are right now. We're not back to normal where we got 1,000 people dying every day. And it's just, it's awful. And that, like, I mean, I guess I'll leave it at that. But just, it didn't need to be this bad. And now, look, I mean, people are dying. 1,000 people are dying every day. That's worse than not having college football. Although it just, it's really when, because I don't think we're going to have college football either. And when the reality of that sets in, it's just really going to suck. And you know what? It's just, you know, my life has personally been affected. You know, I actually, I had this thing in March and I was pretty damn sick with it. So I was lucky enough to recover, but it's no joke. And it's just, you know, just things like that are reminders that we're not back to normal. Things aren't okay. And, you know, we're not functioning as we should, as we normally would in our society. So it sucks. And yeah, it's things like college football. It's things like when my law school starts up in 2 weeks, where we can't have in-person classes. It's going to be, you know, over the computers, remote learning. So I wish we could get back to normal. You know, I do understand that people are like, well, you know, we need this to get back to normal. It's like, yeah, we do. But we, you know, we can't just ignore what's going on and try to play college football just to say, oh, you know, this is normal. It doesn't work like that. So it's just a really unfortunate situation. I wish we could play, though, because, you know, I was actually kind of looking forward to seeing Notre Dame actually being able to play as a full-fledged member of the ACC and be eligible to play in the ACC championship. That would have been kind of cool to see for a year. But I don't see how it's happening. I don't see how a sport like football, especially college football, with the logistics of it, how it can possibly work without getting just these massive outbreaks of infections going between teams. So I don't see how it works, and it sucks. Let's be honest.
Yeah. No argument. I mean, that's pretty much what I'm saying. I think you guys put it pretty well. So no, very good. And on the golf front, I mean, we're happy to see that that's functioning relatively normally, but it still isn't, because you don't see fans. You don't see anybody cheering that Morikawa drive on 16. It's a very different time, and everybody keeps saying, oh, we're going to get through it, we're going to get through it, we're going to get through it. But the one thing I always say to people is that's up to us. It's not just going to happen. You have to make it happen. And I think the problem is there are too many people that are just in the dark about their impact on what a pandemic is and what it can do. And that's just too bad. It's just unfortunate. I think that's the best way to put it. It's just unfortunate that we can't seem to come together to do anything, any one thing these days. And that stinks for me too. It's just, I'm glad that we have our personal health at this moment, but I can't say that's the same for people that we know. I mean, I think you've seen it in your family. John, you've probably seen it in your family, too. I've seen it in my family, friends of family, and all so on. I just wish people would get it. I don't need to see paper, little flyer to say, you're not a man if you wear a mask. Fuck that. Go fuck yourself, whoever said that. But I did see that. It was like, who makes up this stuff? It's a real problem. So rather than get on that tangent any further, we can give it to final thoughts. John, I'll give it to you first. Obviously, the golf has been tremendous. Let's give it to you for the final say, and then we'll wrap it up, and then we'll give it to Mike, and same thing.
Yeah, after that last segment, I think, you know, they accuse us of being Corona bros and rooting against sports after that commentary, which is the stupidest thing ever. But in any event,
Yeah, I mean, the PGA Championship was amazing. Golf continues to deliver, and you know, we'll hope for more great tournaments coming up. And like we said, I mean, golf is a sport that we can at least count on to be a distraction for us on television over the coming weeks and months, and even just for like personally, it's a great thing to even get outdoors and, you know, play your own game. You know, I got to play the other day on Friday, and it was awesome. You know, it's just, again, a sport you can do outdoors, get your exercise, and be relatively safe in terms of, you know, this COVID world that we're living in. So good stuff all around. And you know, thanks again, Dave, for setting up the podcast, and we look forward to being back again, I'm assuming, for the U.S. Open recap, you know, in a month from now, which will be a lot of fun. So, you know, should be a fun month of golf, and you know, we'll see who comes out on top on the FedEx Cup, and I'm sure we'll discuss that as well on that podcast. So, good stuff as always, Dave.
Yeah, thank you very much, John. I mean, the feeling is mutual. And by the way, great job out of you on your various FanDuel finishes. You had a nice one a couple weeks ago, I believe, getting a money finish. Good stuff. You know, I try to learn from both.
Yeah, I've been doing pretty well actually. Mike was the big winner this past weekend.
Yeah.
But I had my it was like the Stars and Scrubs strategy. So I picked this guy from Austria, Matthias Schwab. Like, he was literally min price on FanDuel, but on DraftKings he was much, much higher. So whenever I see something like that, I try to go for a value play, and I jammed like five top players in. But unfortunately he missed the cut, and I missed the money by literally 1 point. So yeah, I just needed Jason Day to stay tied for second and I would have gotten it. But overall, it's been a very successful run of FanDuel since the tour started, and that definitely adds to the viewing for sure. I mean you can't say it doesn't. But yeah, Mike did a great job this past week getting the win, so I think we've all done fairly well with the duels since the golf started.
Yeah, for sure. I think I've finished first like at least once, maybe twice, and then I finished like a, you know, top three a couple other times. So we've certainly taken our observations and applied them to selecting good FanDuel players. So Mike, final thoughts and congrats, man. That's a great win in the PGA Championship FanDuel that we had.
Yeah, thank you. That's it's actually my third win since the restart, so I'm on an absolute roll on this, much more so than I've ever been, like in the past couple of years that we've really been doing this. So I don't know, I don't have any magic secret to it. I mean, just generally, I mean, I guess I kind of do what John does a little bit, is that I definitely take like at least one, sometimes two guys that are low on the price number. And I just figure, okay, these guys can, even if I don't think they can win or realistically contend, I could see, you know, if they have a good week, making the top 25 and easily making the cut. And then you can try to load up with the more talented players. But yeah, I'll echo some of what John said. You know, we've, as difficult as this has been and as disruptive as the COVID pandemic has been for our society, we've been able to have golf come back, and for 4 days a week, you can throw it on the TV and try to escape from things a little bit. Now, the fans aren't there, but it does kind of let you, it restores a little bit of a sense of normalcy when you're able to turn on the golf every single week and just see it being played. So it's good. It's relaxing, gets you away from the problems of the real world, which we have plenty of right now. And also, in turn, you know, John mentioned how people have been able to get out and play golf. Yeah, here in New Jersey was one of the first things that was able to come back. Things are much more opened up now than they were, you know, a few months ago. But numbers in terms of people playing golf and participation are apparently through the roof. Like every place I've gone, I've asked the people in the clubhouse or the check-in guy, you know, how are your numbers? And they're all saying, like, it's record, like record setting numbers. So you have people that are never really played golf before getting into it. You have people that have sort of given up the game, come back to it. So it's good to see, because even though it does make it a little bit harder to get a tee time some in some occasions. You know, the numbers in terms of people participating in golf had been declining. And I do kind of worry about it, like, okay, over the next 20 years, what's that going to mean for public courses around here? So, and we'll see where it goes from here. Maybe it'll lead to a permanent bump in participation, because one of the things about golf is it's difficult, it's time consuming, and it really takes a lot of effort to become even a like halfway decent player so you can get around the course without completely hacking it up. And I think with where we are in it, where we are in the world right now, you know, there's more time to spend in a pursuit with something like that as compared to as how it would be when things are normal. So people have the incentive now to spend more time playing golf, and I hope it continues. It's a good thing. So I guess we'll be talking to each other in a month for the U.S. Open recap. Fingers crossed that we can get a Bryson DeChambeau PED suspension between now and then, because we didn't get into that.
But we didn't.
The guy put on 50 pounds in a year, and people are like, oh, there's nothing to see here. Yes, there is something to see here. Now, I'm sure he could have done so naturally, but let's be honest. What's the most likely route for someone doing that? And I can tell you right now that casual fans are talking about that sort of stuff, because my boss, who's a casual golf fan, like the first thing he asked me about golf this year when I started working there was like, do you think DeChambeau's on steroids? And I'm like, well, I don't know if he's on steroids, but do I think he's using something illegal? Probably. So we'll have that in the background. And I'll tell you, if he does test positive, I will be as elated as I was when I found out that Craig Carton got arrested. it would be one of those, like, you know what? I shouldn't necessarily be getting joy out of this occasion, but I will.
Yeah. Everybody on those broadcasts seemed to talk up the milkshakes. It's like, it's not the fucking milkshakes. Come on. Who's thinking it's milkshakes? It's not milkshakes. Give me a break. So, Mike, you've been on top of that for a while. I would certainly share that vindication, well, for you, on your behalf. I think it's because you've been on top of that for a while. So, guys, this has been a lot of fun. And, again, I want to thank you both for coming on. It really is cool to do this again. As you were saying, it does establish a sense of normalcy. And I look forward to doing it again a month from now. It should be fun. So, all the best for now. Keep doing what you do with the FanDuel and the golf. And we'll do it again in a month. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Take care, Dave. Guys.
See ya.
Take care, guys. Have a good evening. That's our show. That's John. That's Mike. This is Dave. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Oh, forgive the language I was using tonight. Some alcoholic beverages contributed to that particular vernacular. But beyond that, we hope you've enjoyed it. It has been fun, and we're back in a day or so, hopefully, with our latest NBA report. That's coming up with Chris and Georgia. But for the meanwhile, we hope you have a wonderful evening. Enjoy the rest of the week, and do enjoy the golf to come. There's a lot of it on the schedule. We will see you next time. So you